Today at Radio Verulam, we are once again speaking to local MP Daisy Cooper to get the answers to your questions. And remember, if you've not been lucky to get answers from Daisy this month, she will be back again next month in November. But Daisy, for you, it has been a very busy period for you since we last talked. It's been your first month in charge as deputy leader of the Liberal Democrats Party. What has been different in this month to maybe your roles before?
I think September and October are a very busy month anyway in politics, because we normally have party conference season. So what normally happens is that Parliament closes down for 3 weeks and MPs go off to their various party conferences in normally seaside locations, you know, like Bournemouth and Brighton and places like that. But this year, the party conference season happened virtually, so it happened online, and Parliament has remained sitting. So we've had probably about 6 weeks straight now of votes and legislation. It's been incredibly busy time in Parliament. And I guess as deputy, the big sort of change for me has been that there's been a lot more sort of media engagement, I guess, in support, supporting Ed as leader. So during party conference, I think I did 12 interviews over the space of 4 days. That was alongside 4 speeches and all sorts of other things. It's been it's provided the media profile to raise attention of some of the issues that we're facing in St Albans.
Did you miss being beside the seaside at all, or was it still like a normal working month for you in terms of the conference month?
I really enjoy going to Lib Dem conference. It's an opportunity to see sort of friends of mine that I've known in the Lib Dem family for 10 years or so. I always love being by the seaside, a coastal girl, at heart. I think everyone's missed it this year. But instead, I spent 4 days glued to my laptop in my makeshift home office, terrified that my Wi-Fi connection was going to let me down in the middle of a crucial speech. So it was quite stressful.
I mean, you have cats as well. I mean, they always seem to bother me when I'm doing interviews and stuff. So that's also a problem, but a blessing as well, you know. So, but talking about the conference month, as we said there, the electorate looks forward to it, because I think it really does give an opportunity to explain what each party is willing to do over the next year for them. We come into this month, 2 new leaders of parties, and as you said there, Ed Davey is your new leader. So what would you like to explain are the main points that will be different from your previous leader's stance, and what can they expect from the Lib Dems in 2020 going onwards?
Well, party conference for the Liberal Democrats is quite different from the party conferences for the other parties, because our party policy is made by our members. And so some of the motions that our members put forward was about adopting a universal basic income. We think it's a very powerful case for this, given that there's so many people are falling between the cracks in terms of not being able to get universal credit or not getting any support from the government. So that was a big debate that we had. In the light of the Black Lives Matter movement, we adopted a new party policy on tackling racial inequality. In light of the COVID pandemic, we talked about the importance of the government getting test, trace and isolate fixed, as well as providing mental health support, especially for our frontline workers. But in terms of how Ed Davey, as our new leader, used his conference speech, he gave a very personal and poignant speech about his own experience as a carer. And he talked about how when he was growing up as a young man, he cared for his mother, he then cared for his nana, and now as a father, he cares for his disabled son. And he has talked in incredibly passionate and personal terms about how he wants to become the voice for the 9 million unpaid carers that we have in the UK. And that's very much a personal mission of his.
Was it difficult for Ed to kind of convey that story? Because, you know, seeing him up there, that was a deeply personal kind of statement and commitment to the unpaid workers. But was it hard for him to kind of discuss that to the public on an issue, you know, where family members have sadly been suffering and he has had to dedicate a lot of his life to it?
I mean, there's no doubt that making that kind of speech is tough for anybody. And I think probably many of our friends and neighbours and your listeners, you know, will either themselves, you know, they'll know from their own personal experience, or they'll know from other people, that when you go through a very, very tough time, it can often make you sort of a tougher person. You know, you when you have to fight battles, you become a tough person, and often you want to sort of fight on behalf of other people, so other people don't have to go through what you have been through. And I meet countless people, countless numbers of people in my constituency surgeries who have gone through exactly that, and they will know, as I think, you know, that they will know how difficult it is to speak about your personal experience. So there's no doubt that it would have been a tough thing for Ed to do, but I think it was important for people to know a little bit more about him as leader and what drives him and his politics.
Now, another leader that actually you have talked about, the Labour Party leader, after finding about what he is about, you've actually said that he is closer to your values than Jeremy Corbyn. So talking about the new Labour in 2020, much like the new Liberal Democrats of 2020, what areas specifically do you think Starmer and you align on?
Okay, so I mean, as a Liberal and as a Liberal Democrat, I would say that I am I'm pro-internationalist. I think it's important we work with other countries. I'm pro-business. I am very pro having strong public services, and I am pro-environment. So those are probably, you know, I'm pro-civil liberties and individual rights. And those are sort of the core values at the heart of our party. In terms of where I think Keir Starmer is, I think he's certainly a lot closer to the Lib Dems than Jeremy Corbyn was on our internationalism. You know, we all know that Jeremy Corbyn was at best lukewarm about the EU. Let's leave it at that. And I think Keir Starmer is certainly more enthusiastic about the UK working with international partners in the EU and beyond. I think when it comes to, you know, Liberal Democrats have always said you need strong public services, but also, you know, you need to be able to support business as well, because business is often a better place to innovate. And I think Keir Starmer is probably closer to our views on the importance of having that mixed economy, whereas I think Jeremy Corbyn was close to the idea of nationalising quite a lot of big major industries. And I guess on the third, a third example might be that, you know, under Jeremy Corbyn, there is no doubt that the anti-Semitism ran rife and wasn't cracked down on at all. And certainly lots of Labour members themselves were very frustrated with that. And so far, you know, initial signals are that under Keir Starmer, that's the kind of that kind of discrimination and racism is not being permitted and is being cracked on. Quite, you know, it's been cracked down on quite hard. So I guess, you know, on the internationalism, on the sort of mixed economy, and on the importance of tackling discrimination in all its forms, I'd say Keir Starmer is probably closer to us than Jeremy Corbyn.
So let's move it back to your leader, Ed Davey, and discussed at the party he had an idea for a post-COVID green economy. How would you like to explain that the party would achieve this proposed 75% cut of emissions by 2030 and then net zero by 2045?
Well, first of all, let me just say how important this is. You know, we have got 10 years left. We've got 10 years left to save our planet. And it may not even be that anymore. It might be 9. I think I was saying 10 during the general election, so it's probably more like 9 years left to save our planet. We need really, you know, real urgent action. And I can't sort of overstate that enough. And whilst the pandemic has been awful, absolutely awful in many respects, there is now an opportunity to rebuild our economy in a way that we didn't seize that opportunity when we had the 2008 financial crisis. And it will be absolutely unforgivable if we didn't seize that opportunity to turn our country into a green economy. So I probably haven't got time to go through all of our various measures, but certainly, you know, if anybody wants more details, they can email me and I can set them all out. But basically, we set our plans in our 2019 general election manifesto. You know, we said, you know, we want an emergency 10-year programme of action. And by 2030, we want to have 80% of our electricity from renewable energy. We want to plant 60 million trees a year. We want every single new car that's bought to be electric. We want to insulate 30 million homes by 2030, starting with those who are living in fuel poverty. You know, we want to electrify the railways. We want 5 green acts to cover, you know, clean air and nature. We want to charge people for short flights. You know, we want to have a clean air act so that our air meets World Health Organization guidelines. You know, we've got a very long shopping list of the action that we want to take, but we've planned it out, we've costed it, and we will continue to petition the government and other colleagues in Parliament to try and build support for a green recovery.
Do you feel, though, that at the moment the Conservatives have actually committed to levelling up their ideas of a green economy? But do you think that that actually falls short then? And also kind of linking it to the internationalism, would the Liberal Democrats actually work on a global stage to bring about more eco-friendly economies worldwide?
I mean, so in terms of the government's agenda, I mean, I think we've seen, you know, the government's, you know, the Conservative government cut subsidies for solar, and they're not taking the climate emergency seriously enough. The Independent Committee on Climate Change, I think, described the government's approach to tackling the climate emergency like the approach of Dad's Army. You know, I mean, they're just not taking the kind of steps that are necessary in terms of how soon they're needed and the urgency, but also the scale of what's needed as well. Now, you know, the government at the moment, you know, it can't get the basics right. And that's really frustrating. It can't even get test, trace and isolate fixed, which means that as a country, we're lurching from crisis week to week. And for as long as we're doing that, it means that we can't plan for our long-term future. And we need to have a government that can both, you know, tap its head and you know, circle its tummy at the same time. And it just doesn't seem to be able to do that. But we need the government to tackle the immediate crises that we're facing around, you know, not having a test, trace and isolate system that's working. But once we fix the immediate crises, we do need a longer term plan. And all these sort of little announcements about, you know, work placements here or short retraining programs, I mean, they're just not up to the job. You know, we need a serious, credible 5-10 year plan from the government. And there was an opportunity for them to present that this autumn with the budget, and they've now cancelled the budget. So we'll continue to press the government to do more and to do it quicker.
Ed Davey also discussed the answer for Liberal Dems' electoral success. He said it is to listen to what people are really telling us and to change. However, on Daily Politics, you discussed the party's commitment to return to the EU, that it is your long-term objective to rejoin the EU at some point. Now, YouGov's most recent poll showed that the economy and healthcare are actually now the two issues that the electorate worry about the most, and commented, this is the YouGov commenting, that it would be quite something if Brexit were to overtake healthcare and the economy as the number one issue facing the UK. So is this listening to the electorate, Daisy? Is this what they're telling you? Because do you not risk being left behind, as Ed himself said, fighting the same battles in the same way? Or is this something different?
No, I don't think that's sort of a fair characterisation. I mean, you know, Liberal Democrats are a pro-European party, and we've never tried to hide that fact. You know, we're pro-European, we're internationalists, we believe that to tackle the big issues facing our country over the next 10 years or so, whether that's climate change or the regulation of big tech or whether it's the migration crisis, whatever it might be, we need to work with our international partners. And Liberal Democrats have always said that the interests of the UK are better served in the EU. What we're saying is we want to maintain our long-term commitment to rejoin the EU, and that's a long-term objective. We're not campaigning for that as our number one priority right now. Right now, we are listening to what people are telling us, and we are speaking up on the concerns that they are raising. We've got students who've gone back to school and they can't get tests. We've got, you know, young students being effectively locked up in some universities because they can't access tests. We've got people who are not sure whether they're going to be able to see their families at Christmas. We've got frontline workers who are exhausted in a way that they haven't ever been before, now facing a second wave of coronavirus. We've got you know, lots of different communities around the UK, you know, questioning the government's strategy in terms of restrictions and what restrictions are needed and when, and wondering why the government isn't following the science. These are the issues that we're focusing on right now. But just because we're focusing on all of these issues right now doesn't mean that we're going to suddenly abandon you know, a core value that runs through our veins. Of course, we think that we want to rejoin the EU at some point in the future, but that's for a future debate. What we're doing right now is listening to what people are telling us, and we're speaking up for them on the issues that are facing us as a country right now.
Now, issues currently facing our local community. As always here with Radio Verulam, we put it to the community and we called for questions for you, Daisy. And so let's move into it. And Michael has actually asked the question here along a very important issue that you've actually been championing as well, the issue of 10 p.m. curfew versus lockdown. So he's actually said, Daisy, you've been very vocal against the 10 p.m. curfew, but then the scientists in the SAGE report actually call for a harsher lockdown. What is going to happen?
Sure. Well, I mean, Liberal Democrats have always said that we will follow the science. And the revelations from SAGE, which is the advisory group of scientists that advise the government, on Friday evening were absolutely astonishing. And at the same time, they revealed that they had recommended that the government do a two-week circuit breaker sort of lockdown last month. And at the same time, they also said that the 10 p.m. curfew would have marginal effect. So I think what the public want are measures that will work. What is clear is that the scientists are strongly recommending and have recommended weeks ago that we have a circuit breaker lockdown to try and get the rates under control. And at the same time, they were highlighting that the 10 p.m. curfew was going to have a very small effect. And actually, not only was it going to not have a very big effect on reducing the spread of coronavirus, but right across the country, it's actually backfired. Now, there are different ways in which you can make curfews work. So, for example, in Wales, they had a curfew, but what they said was, you have to stop serving alcohol at a particular time, but people can then have extra drinking up time, which means they all leave pubs and restaurants of their own accord. And that really helped. But they also, in Wales, closed down off licences at the same time. That didn't happen in England. What we ended up with was everybody getting kicked out of pubs and restaurants and bars at the same time, meaning we had enormous crowds of people on public transport, in the streets. We had it in St Albans. You saw pictures, in Leeds and London and other places, all piling onto the tube and onto the metros, and piling into off licences as well. And a lot of small business owners of off licences have reported that they were victims of outrageous abuse and people going in there without masks, demanding more alcohol. I mean, it was really backfiring, and it was bad for business as well. So we will follow the science. SAGE did say there needs to be a circuit breaker. Keir Starmer has come out and called for that. Liberal Democrats are backing that because the science warrants it. And so we have to follow the science on these things.
So do we expect to see a circuit breaker lockdown in St Albans in the near future then?
So a circuit breaker lockdown would be for the entire country. That's what the circuit breaker idea would be. And we don't know. We simply don't know, because that's the debate that's happening at the moment. It's something that Labour have called for. Liberal Democrats, as I say, we support that call because that's what the science is suggesting. And ultimately, we need to get the coronavirus under control again. And the reason it's not under control is because the government has utterly failed to develop the test, trace and isolate system. But what we've also said is that if there is a circuit breaker lockdown for a few weeks, then there must be sufficient support for businesses and for individuals so that they can survive, at least an equivalent package to what we've had before, continuing furlough and support for the self-employed for as long as necessary up to June next year. And obviously support for the 3 million workers who have been completely excluded from any government support schemes so far. So if there is a lockdown for the whole country, then there needs to be the support packages that come with that.
And with this SAGE report, as you said there, the kind of lockdown, the circuit breaker lockdown, was all centred around the fact that test and trace would have to be improved. But do you have the confidence? Do you think that the government has the ability to actually improve it over that few week period to give them a little bit of a chance to catch up? Or what else can be done if not?
So there are three, if you imagine a three-legged stool, right, that's the system that we need, with three legs: test, trace and isolate. The government keeps saying that it's doing more tests than any other country in the world. And I think there's some evidence that suggests that might be true. The problem is they're not turning the test results around fast enough, so people aren't getting the test results. The contact tracing rates are incredibly low, and people haven't been given the financial support that they need to isolate. So there's no point having one leg of a stool that's incredibly strong if the other two have completely fallen apart. So it's really important that the government can fix the turnaround times for testing, that it can up the contact tracing rates, and then it can give financial support for those people who are isolating. So what the government could do is give power to local public health directors to completely take control of the contact tracing, because at the moment the statistics show that contact tracing done by local public health authorities is between 90 to 100% successful, whereas the national system is much lower. It's around sort of the 60-70%, and so it's actually a lot more effective. And so the government just needs to relinquish that control to public health directors. And then on the isolate part of the strategy, the third leg of the stool, The government just needs to up the financial support for individuals, because it is completely unacceptable to say to somebody, if you have to self-isolate, you can't go out to work, you've got to wait 6 weeks to get your universal, 5 weeks to get your universal credit payment. It's just unacceptable. And the government had offered a one-off £500 payment, but that's no good if you're feeding a family of four. So we need the government to put a proper package of support in place so that people who need to isolate can do so without putting their own and other people's health at risk.
And just adding to that discussion there, we talked previously, probably a couple of months ago, about the actual test and trace numbers and the breakdown of data. And one of the things that you highlighted was a problem that there wasn't enough breakdown for areas or age or gender or race, you know, all these sorts of important bits of data to actually identify things. Has that improved at all, or is this something else that the government needs to work on for local authorities to effectively either do local lockdowns or during this potential circuit breaker one?
So a lot of that data is coming through now. So we have got what's called postcoded data. So data that's broken down by postcode and all these other categories. That is getting, that information is coming from central government to local public health teams. And so they have got that information and that bit is working. The problem we've had recently is that with a lot of people going to university, they've been getting their tests done at university, but because they haven't had time or they haven't been encouraged to register with their local GP, the system, the national test and trace system, has been set up so that the individual's test results are matched with their sort of health records, which then allocates that back to their GP. And so what we found in St Albans and across Hertfordshire is that there appeared to be an increase in our COVID rates, but actually what had happened was it was a number of young people who had gone away to university in other parts of the country, often hundreds or thousands of miles away, and their results were getting attributed back to Hertfordshire. Those results are now getting sorted out, they've been reallocated to the correct areas, and our coronavirus cases in Hertfordshire remain stable.
I think Wendy has actually given a good question here as well, Daisy. She said, do you find it as difficult as me to keep up with the ever-changing information from the government on the coronavirus restrictions? And why can't the government be clearer? You know, do you actually agree with the tier system yourself as well?
So there has been an enormous amount of confusion over the last few weeks and months, particularly in parts of the northeast, the northwest, and the Midlands, where it hasn't been at all clear as to why some areas have restrictions and some others don't, particularly when some rates are higher in some places and not in others. And there's been a lot of questions saying to the government, well, if rates are higher here, why are they not getting the same restrictions that we're getting? You know, there've been examples of a street where one side of the street are under tougher restrictions than the other side of the street. And so it has been massively complicated for people right across the country, but especially for those who have been living in lockdown for the last 2 or 3 months as well. I think the three-tier system does provide some more clarity. So we have medium, high, and very high. I think that should help clear things up to some degree. But obviously now there are conversations happening between local government leaders in London, in Manchester and other places, and between the government about whether that can be varied in some circumstances. And the government hasn't been clear enough yet about the criteria by which you move up or down along that scale. So we still, I think the three-tier system does provide more clarity, but we still need more information about how people move up and down that scale.
And also, will the message be better conveyed in future? Because we heard in the news, I don't know if you can confirm this, but actually the government didn't meet with too many MPs and local mayors. And actually with the Sunderland situation, they only talked to one of the three MPs for that metropolitan area. Is this something that the government has committed to improving as well, to actually counter this poor ability to get a message across even to its MPs?
You know, the problem we've had over the last few weeks and months has been that the government has given information to selected news outlets, and then elected mayors and local officials and MPs have found out what potential restrictions or actual restrictions are going to be in their area through the press. And that's simply not an acceptable way for the government to operate. And so a number of MPs and elected officials have been saying to the government, you need to meet with us, you need to have meetings. And some of those meetings have started to happen, but there's still clearly quite a lot of unrest and unease amongst local leaders. They're not getting the information from government first, and they are still learning things from the press, so that still needs to be improved.
Now, another kind of message that needs to be improved, this is one from Sally Manning, and she's given us the question that she has two twins in year 11 who are due to sit GCSE exams next year. She's asking, when can we expect clarity on how / when they will be assessed? She explains, at the moment we have no information as to whether they will take place at all. If they do go ahead, then when and what weighting exams will be given versus coursework / teacher assessment? What content will be covered? And she conveys the feeling that it's disgraceful that children continue to be so negatively impacted, and I worry very much for their future careers and mental health. We desperately need some concrete information. Daisy, can you give some concrete information on that, or is that still something that is in plans and in the pipework?
It's a really good question. And there's no doubt that students have had an unbelievably tough time this year, but they're in for a pretty tough time over the next 12 months potentially as well, and there are really grave concerns that if the government doesn't get its act together, that there'll be whole generations of young people who will have missed out on proper education. So the first thing to say is that just a few days ago, on Monday of this week, there was a sort of partial announcement from the government on this, and what they announced was that all GCSE and A-level exams next year would be put back by 3 weeks. And that's to allow additional time for teaching and for learning. But in anticipation of the fact that some students might be self-isolating at that time, for GCSE students, they would be taking one English and one math paper before the May break. In addition to all of that, the government also said that it would be requiring students to be doing their mock exams much earlier. I think, I don't know exactly when, but around the start of next year. And that really does cause a problem. And I highlighted this in a debate on Monday afternoon, that the government, so those announcements, I should say, should provide a degree of clarity. The problem is that MPs like me have been pushing for the government to produce more scenarios. And there is going to be a lot of disruption, we know, over the coming months. And the government needs to produce different scenarios to say how it is going to, which courses can be taught. Teachers need that certainty as well. Are the exams going to be changed so that students are only tested on the modules they're actually taught? It would be desperately unfair to reduce the teaching by, say, 40% and then to be tested on those, and to be faced with questions on those sections in an exam. So the government has made the first few announcements about changes to next year, but we need a lot more information and we need it much faster. And in the debate on Monday, I pointed out two things. The first is that it's actually desperately unfair and contradictory to say we're going to push the exams back by 3 weeks to allow for more teaching, but in case those can't go ahead, well, you're going to do your mocks a lot earlier and that prevents you, that kind of reduces the amount of time you've got to do teaching. So there seems to be a contradiction there in terms of what the government's proposing, but we do need a lot more information about the different scenarios and how other assessments can be used. I am a long-standing advocate of trusting teachers. If you trust teachers to teach children, you should trust them to assess them as well. We know that teacher-moderated assessments are very, very reliable in many cases. And so I think there is a case for using teacher-moderated assessments more. I do think that exams should go ahead if they can in some shape or form, but we've got to be realistic about the fact that they may not be able to go ahead for some students or possibly even for large cohorts of students. The government needs to work through those scenarios urgently. It says it's going to publish more information this autumn, but quite frankly, it was pretty crisp when I left the house this morning. It started to feel a bit like winter. So the government needs to get its skates on.
And just another information problem with schools, and some people have actually sent in a message about this. We saw in the news that certain companies, but also certain schools, are now not giving COVID positive test information and asking people, especially teachers, not to test and trace at all. Is this something that the government will be combating and telling teachers, no, you have to? Because otherwise, it seems counter to the efforts to actually test and trace all individuals so that we can all get to normality as soon as possible?
I'm going to be really honest with you, Jason. I've only seen that story in the last couple of days and I haven't got to the bottom of it. And so until I fully understand what has been said and what hasn't been said, I'm not going to say any more. But if anybody's concerned about it, do encourage them, please, to email me. And once I've got to the bottom of what's happening and what schools have and haven't been told and what regulations are in place, then I'll be able to answer people's questions on that.
So let's move on then to a question that is actually given to Liberal Democrats quite often, and Callum's highlighted this. Why do you feel that the Liberal Democrats are held to account over their failures in the coalition so much more than other parties? It is without doubt mentioned in every discussion about them.
It's a good question. I mean, certainly I find it sort of quite frustrating, but I do understand it. I think fundamentally, before the 2010 general election, there were huge swathes of the country that felt as though the Liberal Democrats were on their side. And they saw our various policies and they could see that we had, you know, around sort of 60 MPs or so. And they generally thought that we were, you know, good eggs that had good policy ideas and that they were generally on their side and speaking up for them. I think because of the financial crisis and the crisis in regulation that happened in 2008, the electoral maths was that we couldn't do a deal with Labour, so we ended up doing a deal with the Conservatives, and I think we ended up signing up to lots of things that were not really part of our manifesto. And I think people felt, and understandably so in some cases, that we were enabling policies that we hadn't been advocating. And I think people felt let down. And I think it would be disingenuous to suggest otherwise. Now, there were some good things that we achieved in coalition, and I won't go through them all now, but people will have heard me talking about them before. But there were two or three things, you know, or a number of things that we did in coalition that were big achievements. But the fact of the matter is that during those years, we were, you know, in total, I think about 8 or 9% of all the MPs in Parliament. We were a very small party. We were a small part of the coalition. And there were some policies that we were able to stop, but there were several that we weren't able to stop. And I think people felt let down by that. And so, you know, we're in no doubt that we recognise that we've now had three difficult general elections. Goes back to what we were saying earlier, and Ed Davey saying that we need to wake up and smell the coffee. And we need to regain that trust and make sure that on a national level, people feel as though we are on their side and talking about the issues that really matter to them.
Do you think, though, that the efforts during that coalition years, some commentators have said that it toned down potential austerity measures. Do you think that that's not contextualised enough?
I would say so. There were lots and lots and lots of things that we stopped the Conservatives doing, and you have to just look at what's happened since 2015 when they've been in power on their own to see that the cuts have gone much deeper and much faster. And not only have they gone much deeper and much faster, but the Conservative Party that existed during coalition has all but vanished. You know, it was under David Cameron a reasonably centrist kind of party, still a Conservative Party, but a centrist Conservative Party. And now it has become unbelievably right-wing. And those kind of right-wing forces that have always existed in the Conservative Party, but were certainly held at bay during those coalition years, is now running riot. And that has led arguably to the Brexit vote, to the hostile environment, to some very dodgy announcements on procurement contracts and who they're being on various contracts and who they're being handed to. I won't say anything more severe than that, I'm really worried about how right-wing this government has gone, about the rise of populism, about the attacks on the attacks on our press, the attacks on the independence of our judiciary. This is a seriously right-wing Conservative Party, and quite frankly, I want nothing to do with it.
Well, on that issue of attacking the judiciary, Mandy has actually raised this point, and she's asked, do you agree with the recent discussion amongst lawyer groups that Priti Patel's dangerous rhetoric puts them at risk? Why is the government allowed to persevere with this approach and also the illegal way that they are treating refugees? Could you maybe clear up those comments for some people who may not know them, but also add your comment to it? What is happening there?
Yeah, so to provide some context, Priti Patel, who is the Home Secretary, is in charge of a number of things, you know, including immigration. And when people come to this country, they have a right to seek asylum. And some people are successful in their asylum applications and others are not. Every time somebody arrives in the country, they might want to get some legal advice. And it is the responsibility of a lawyer to tell them what their rights are. That is why we have lawyers. It's to make sure that every single individual can defend themselves in the eyes of the law. And that is a fundamental principle at the heart of the way that we run our country. Priti Patel, who's the Home Secretary, has criticised some of these lawyers as being sort of campaigning lawyers and suggesting that they are driven by a certain set of values that she doesn't agree with, whereas in reality they're just doing their job and they're advising individuals on what their rights are. And it's a very, very dangerous precedent when you have a member of the government who is responsible for setting policy on immigration attacking lawyers for simply doing their job of informing people what their rights are in front of in front of the law. And so it is very dangerous, and I mean, she can get away with it because she's a politician and politicians can say what they think. But fundamentally, I think we're seeing many groups like Liberty and others fighting back on this point. Lawyers themselves have said how dangerous this is. And we have to make sure that all of the institutions that provide fairness in our society are protected. And the fundamental point about courts and the independence of the judges who sit in those courts is that they are there to make decisions on the basis of fairness and on the basis of evidence. And as soon as you start attacking them and politicising them, then you end up promoting political points of view in a court of law, and that ends badly for everybody, particularly the most marginalised.
And just to clear up on that point of asylum seekers, people seeking refuge in the UK, some of the rhetoric has been that it is illegal to do so, but in accordance to UK and international law, is it illegal or is it not illegal to claim asylum in this country?
It's not illegal at all to claim asylum. You can claim asylum. If your asylum is granted, then you are legally have a right to stay here. If your asylum is not granted, you then have a right of appeal. If that is then declined, then you don't have a legal right to stay. So that's what the process is. But nobody arrives in the country and in a state of illegality. People arrive here as somebody who has probably fled war or famine or torture or death threats, and has probably spent every single penny they have. They might well be victims of drug gangs. People who seek asylum have normally been through the worst conditions you could possibly imagine. I think it's a basic state of humanity that we should welcome them with open arms. We should have a fair system. We should provide safe and legal routes for people to come to this country to seek asylum, and then we should process those claims very quickly. We should give them the right to work whilst they're seeking asylum, because many people seek asylum and it can take months and months and months and months and months to process their application, and they're not actually allowed to work in the country and earn money and pay taxes, and we should do that. But I think we need to rediscover our humanity, or certainly the Conservative Party does.
So let's move on to the final question here, and I put this one in because I think 2020 has been hard here. Mary reflects that. Let's try and end on a positive here. So Mary has said 2020 has not been a great year by any measure. Daisy, can you bring a bit of positivity? What are some things that you're looking forward to in the final months of 2020? Mary has mentioned the C word of Christmas. I don't know if that's too soon to mention. But also, what are you looking forward to in 2021?
Yeah, I mean, let's be honest, we're in for a bumpy ride, I think, over the next few months. At best, it's going to be a hugely uncertain time. But at worst, we could see some periods of lockdown again, and none of us know how that's going to play out. So I think there's a lot of uncertainty and a lot of apprehension about what the next few months have got in store. But autumn is my favourite season of the year. And so what am I going to look forward to? I am going to look forward to going for a walk in the park with my husband so we can kick some orange leaves down the track. I'm looking forward to my birthday because I love birthdays, and we'll probably have a nice meal in the house. So if we're allowed to go out, we will. I think Halloween might be quite special for lots of small children. I know that this year people probably won't be handing out sweets to children, but I think that I've seen something on Facebook where some parents are organising where if you put some sort of Halloween imagery or something in your window, then the parents can give the sweets to the children, you know, on your behalf, kind of thing. And of course there's Christmas, so I'm hoping very much that I can see some members of my family for Christmas. We'll see how we go.
And in 2021, is there things, you know, personally or politically, that you're really looking forward to?
I think it's too early to tell. Let's see. We've got a very difficult few months ahead of us, and I'm just very focused at the moment on doing everything I can to support people in St Albans over the next few months. I can't at the moment. My horizon is the next few days and the next few weeks. I haven't even thought about 2021 yet, but maybe by the next time we do an interview, next time we chat, I'll think of something.
And finally, just for the listeners here, to maybe send you well wishes on your birthday, can you remind them what day to maybe send you a little card or something?
No, I don't need cards. It's at the end of October, but I'm not giving you the date.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you very much for your time today, Daisy. It's always useful to get answers from your local politicians. And for those of you who didn't have their question answered, Daisy will be returning next month. But for now, thank you very, very much, Daisy.
Pleasure.